Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court. Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning and welcome to this oral submission docket of the Supreme Court of Texas. This is the first time in the history of the Supreme Court that we have sat in El Paso, and the first time since 1891 that the court has sat outside of Austin or outside of one of the state's law schools. So it is a historic occasion for us. This morning there are three causes on our oral submission docket. And in the order in which they will be presented, they are, first, Bascom W. Bentley III versus Joe Ed Button and others from Anderson County. Then, Long Distance International Incorporated and Star Marketing Service Incorporated versus Telefonos de Mexico, S.A. de C.V. and others from Bexar County. And E.I. DuPont de Nemours and Company versus Pecan Valley Nut Company and others from Comanche County. In each matter, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete these arguments before noon. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Bentley versus Martin.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Hatchell will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is a defamation case brought by sitting district judge Bascom W. Bentley against two members of a local access radio television program for what the Court of Appeals called an 18-month campaign in which Judge Bentley was repeatedly called corrupt and a criminal, someone who ought to be in jail. The affirmative judgment in this case in favor of Judge Bentley individually against Joe Ed Button and Colonel Gates, the two participants, was affirmed in part and reversed in part by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals' reversal as to Colonel Jackie Gates, one of the participants in the program, as well as that court's affirmance of the trial court's denial of joint and several liability as a result of the conspiracy, results in two very interesting questions that are presented to this court this morning. Question number one is, can a defamation defendant be liable for publishing an agreement with another's defamation, even if the act of publication does not itself contain defamatory language? Issue number two is, does a defamation plaintiff have to obtain a finding of damages related explicitly to a conspiracy, even though the jury finds that the members of that conspiracy committed defamation and it awards damages against them?
Aside from those two issues, do you believe that the Court of Appeals applied the proper standard of review and analyzed the case under the appropriate standard of review?
Yes, Your Honor. The Court did apply the proper standard of review in every respect. The only
decided that it was the appropriate standard of review, I'll give it that, but did it not analyze it under, say, a preponderance of the evidence or some other de facto standard?
Your Honor, I do not see that. In this particular case, the defamatory statements themselves were undisputed. They're caught on videotape. So you're dealing with undisputed facts in this case. And I think, and the trial court in this case determined that the defamatory statements were defamatory per se. So once you're beyond that, it seems to me, then you're simply left with the question of publication and actual malice.
So you're saying there unequivocally, no doubt about it.
There's no question.
Establish clear and convincing evidence.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. In applying clear and convincing evidence, do we look only at the evidence which supports the verdict, or do we have to evaluate all the evidence in weigh all the evidence to determine whether or not all the evidence amounts to clear and convincing.
Must weigh all the evidence. And there's no question about it. And I think the Court of Appeals decision in this case is really remarkable for doing that. It devotes an enormous amount of verbiage to analyzing each one, all aspects and all sides of the grounds which were proper to contend that these statements were, quote, true.
Well, wasn't there evidence that Mr. Button genuinely believed that Mr. Bentley was corrupt or had faults along those lines? In other words, this is a situation where he thought, well, Mr. Bentley was a fine, upstanding young man, but he was going to rip him apart anyway. He thought that Mr. Bentley was corrupt, and his effort was to undertake an investigation and make allegations that perhaps he was not corrupt, just as he thought he was not corrupt. I mean, was corrupt, just as he thought he was corrupt.
Two answers to that question. The answer to your first observation, yes, Mr. Bunton will tell you that he genuinely, well, he believed that. He's an interested party, and that testimony can be factored out. I don't think that the clear and convincing standard requires the court to factor in credibility choices for the jury. The second thing that I would say in response to that is, there were in discovery 8 listed grounds for the defamation. Each one of those grounds was reviewed in the trial court in great detail and reviewed by the Court of Appeals in great detail. And I think even two of the experts who testified in this case would confirm that no rational person would entertain the belief that any of the grounds, and the only grounds that justified the defamation, would suggest to a reasonable person a legitimate, honestly held belief.
Mr. Hatchell, looking to the first issue that you mentioned, which is part of your petition to the court, and that is the question of whether or not a defendant in a case such as this can be liable for publishing a statement without actually uttering the words that are alleged to be defamatory. What are the limits of such liability if we were to recognize that as a basis for liability?
Interesting question, Your Honor, and first of all, let me say that the court, I'm sure, is familiar that in the Dolcifino case, you have held that the overall impact of the publication can be defamatory even though the words, the statements are true and they are non-defamatory. But you raise an interesting question. And I think in my own mind, I would say that in this case, and I'm sure the court understands that the trial judge submitted this case in an interesting way, and it was his charge. He asked if Colonel Gates agreed with Joette Bunton's defamatory statement and if he published that agreement. I think what Your Honor's concern is the proximity. And I do think that there must be some either temporal or physical proximity. In this particular case, we don't have to worry about that because the publication is almost simultaneous with the utterance by Mr. Buck. So I would say that you should have a close temporal nexus or you should have a close physical nexus. And let me see if I can give you what I mean by physical nexus. Let's assume that someone during campaign season, Your Honor, places in my yard over which I have control a very defamatory placard against Justice Hankinson, accusing her of corruption and criminality. Maybe I'm sympathetic to that, and because I'm in control of being able to remove that, the restatement would say that that is also a defamation.
So is control then an element of recognizing liability in this instance?
Well, I think in some instances it could be. In this particular instance, I think the temporal nexus one that's very important.
Can I be held responsible if I happen to be in the room with someone else? There's temporal proximity and physical proximity when they make a defamatory statement.
But no publication.
I'm in a room full of people, and I hear the defamatory statement, and I happen to be standing right next to the person.
Actually, the restatement in some instances would probably support that. I do not know, and I do not think that Texas law needs to go quite so far. Liable by silence, I think, is a very slippery slope that we do not need to go down. In this particular case, what we have are positive. We have words, positive expressions of affirmation We also have a failure to purge a program of the contemporary, of the defamatory statement.
Well, is it also critical that Colonel Gates was in a position of being co-host on this show and making decisions about what would be broadcast or not? Is that critical to the analysis
as well? It would be
critical,
Your Honor, in two respects. Number one, his affirmation using the word, quote, yeah, or asking who is the most corrupt, and basically encouraging him. His status as the director of the show and someone who represents that he has the authority to clean it up, I think gives him the cachet with the public to understand that he is giving an authoritative affirmation.
Mr. Hatchell, before your time is up, would you go to the second question that you said you were going to discuss with us, and that has to do with the charge issue?
The charge issue is a very interesting question, Your Honor. My position on that is the Court of Appeals has basically held, it seems to me, that in a case where you have two co-conspirators in a conspiracy to defame, and the Court of Appeals actually held that only one of them made defamatory remarks, that you basically have to have three questions. You have to have a defamation by conspirator one, defamation by conspirator two, and a question asking about the defamation of the, quote, conspiracy. The difficulty I have with that is that conspiracies do not defame. Conspirators defame. If you look at this charge and you do not know the argument that Colonel Gates will present to you, that there were defamatory statements made before this conspiracy arose, there is nothing wrong with this charge. One of the problems I have is the Court of Appeals approach seems to assume and almost choose where it thinks the jury believed the conspiracy started and what evidence it utilized in assessing damages. That, to me, invades the province of the jury. I think in a situation like we have, where they are claiming a temporal, factual defect in the charge, that it was Colonel Gates' obligation and Mr. Bunton's obligation to request from the court some limiting instruction or some grid by which it could apportion the damages.
Is it your position that there was error in the charge and that any objection to it has been waived, or do you think that this charge is appropriate in the first instance, but if we were to determine that it isn't, that any error has been waived?
Your Honor, we made the tactical decision in the beginning of this case that we did not want a reversal and remand as a result of charge error. We believe that the charge, even though it was not necessarily the one we requested, we believe that the charge was an appropriate one. We have, however, as a result of the Court of Appeals holding, now asked this court to sever, if the Court of Appeals is correct, to sever and remand, because it seems to me what the Court of Appeals has held is that there is almost a separate cause of action. As the court knows from its dealings with the harmless error cases, Torrington and others, that we just normally don't reverse for defects in the charge and render. Nobody objected to this charge on that ground. So that is our principal portion under Allen versus American National Life Insurance Company and Osterberg versus PECA. This charge becomes the law for this case. No one was complaining about that. And in Allen, indeed, this court held that charge essentially was an assumption that the parties wanted the case to be disposed of in this way. So, but if the Court of Appeals is correct that there is a third issue, and we believe that's severable, and it should be.
Mr. Hatchell, let me ask you again about the standard of review that the CA should have applied. I believe that you've agreed the clear and convincing standard is the one that has to be applied.
No question. This court has held that in Dolcifino, and that is consistent.
I don't think there's any dispute about that. But the Court of Appeals, in reviewing the evidence, spoke in terms of scintilla of evidence and some evidence. How do you reconcile those two terms, and did they conduct a proper review?
Your Honor, I think that there would be, in any appropriate analysis, an analysis of the record to determine that there was at least a scintilla of evidence to get you over the no evidence threshold. But, of course, the court must go beyond that. So I don't think that the mere use of the phrase scintilla is fatal to the Court of Appeals.
Do you think that would be an improper review? I mean, could you find a scintilla to support the clear and convincing? Would that work? How is that supposed to look?
I've never thought about that.
Well, the charge itself defines clear and convincing, and are we to find that there's a scintilla to support that clear and convincing finding? Or how does that work? I don't think there's ever been an articulation of how we apply that standard.
There has not, and I have not thought about the scintilla. The scintilla rule, as formulated in Josky versus Irvine, is a rule of inferences. And it's clearly a rule of inferences only. Justice Garwood, in his article prior to Justice Calvert's article, clearly discusses that in great detail. So I do not think that in a review of the entire record, which would include direct facts as well as inferences, that you could say that you could apply a scintilla of clear and convincing.
So
I think they're two discrete
inquiries. If, in fact, that's what the Court of Appeals did, you'd say that was an improper standard. May have reached the same result with the proper standard, but you might agree that was an improper way to review.
I'm not willing to concede that the Court of Appeals applied an improper standard, because I do think that in certain procedural postures, particularly where you have directed verdicts, and that's what they held in this case, that there was a directed verdict should have been granted, I do think that you would very correctly apply a scintilla to see whether or not you had any evidence at all to which to apply a clear and convincing standard.
Mr. Hatchell, I know your time's up, but a quick question here. I don't know if it's a quick answer, though. The objection to any evidence supporting a $7 million award, it appears that if there's a finding of malice, which there was here, then really it's entirely up to the jury to determine what the damages will be. Is there any sort of First Amendment implication to an award of $7 million in a defamation case dealing with a public figure?
Your Honor, I guess if we hearken back to the beginnings of the due process overlay on punitive damages, you might find an analogy there. And I would think, probably having worked with that issue now for several years, that there may well be a due process implication insofar as magnitude is concerned. I suppose that would be when you got to the point where you were putting people out of business and making the expressions for which they've been found liable and be so opprobrious that to render them, you know, just simply ineffective.
Has that been
raised? That's a very difficult question.
Has it been raised here?
It has not been raised in this case. It's not, but an intriguing question.
The Court of Appeals talks about truth as an affirmative defense. I know there was no... Perhaps it's not an objection to the charge, but is that correct law after Gertz?
The court does hold the truth is a quote defense. Does the word affirmative add anything to that? I think not. The way I view that, of course, it's also statutory as well. The way I view that is what the Court of Appeals was holding was that it is certainly our burden in the first instance to establish falsity falsity, that's as far as it goes. If the defamation defendants wish to establish a counter with truth, I think what the Court of Appeals was holding they had to do so as a matter of law, because we established falsity and the jury essentially found that. And if you're going to allege truth, as they did as to the eight instances involved, you had to do so as a matter of law. And I don't read that statement any beyond that.
Okay. In their scrutiny of the damages, the Court of Appeals makes some reference to the need for a judge's reputation to be well-regarded and high in the community, because judges don't have the power of the person, the sword, and they depend upon public acceptance. Do you think that mindset at all affected it? Was that part of the review standard the Court of Appeals applied in looking at both liability issues and in particular?
Not insofar as I can tell for liability issues, no, I don't. But certainly
it was insofar as damages is concerned, because there was a specific finding, an element of damages on loss of reputation. But I do think that it is very relevant in these cases, particularly assessing the degree of mental anguish that one can suffer.
Doesn't that sort of flip New York Times on its head, though, to say that public officials have, they'll suffer more mental anguish if more people hear bad things about them, and their job is so important that perhaps they need heightened rewards when they're criticized. I mean, isn't that an exact flip of our First Amendment jurisprudence?
Pardon me, Your Honor. I don't think so, Your Honor. Of course, New York Times standard is related to malice. I do think that this court has struggled in Parkway and in other cases to determine whether or not, and to develop tests to determine whether or not mental anguish has been sustained. I think that can be a contextual inquiry. And so I think, given the high degree of public trust that this record shows that this man had, that it was appropriate for the court to say he would also suffer a like degree of mental anguish.
So harder to establish liability for a public figure, but once you do, easier to get to sustain large damage.
I don't know that I would say easier. Perhaps it's even harder, because judges, and I think Judge Bentley even said on the stand that he understands he has to withstand a certain amount of slings and arrows. But when you get to the point of corruption and criminality, I do think that there is a public policy overlay of undermining the entire system of justice through that. And certainly, with someone that this record shows is such a dedicated public servant, it bears upon the degree of mental anguish he suffers.
Any other questions? Thank you, Court. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the Court. Mr. Robert D. Wren and Mr. Joe Ed Button will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Wren will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the Court, my name is Ron Rea, and I represent Colonel Gates. Let me start with the fact that, first of all, the jury didn't find that Colonel Gates made a false statement. The jury didn't find that he made a defamatory statement. The jury didn't find that he made a statement of fact at all. They were not asked that. We asked the Court to submit a straight-running definition question as to Colonel Gates, and the Court refused to do that. So the issue that was submitted was, did he publish his agreement with Mr. Button's statement with actual malice? Now, we have some serious problems with that charge formulation for a number of reasons. First of all, as I indicated, it omits several of the necessary elements of a defamation claim. There is no requirement under this charge that the jury find that what Mr. Gates said was false. And I think under Gertz, Chief Justice Phillips, that falsity is an element of a cause of action of the plaintiff in a public figure case. It is not an affirmative defense, irrespective of what it may be in a private figure or non-media defendant case. It also does not require that the statement be defamatory. If, in fact, they are now contending that what he said has a defamatory meaning, then at least we ought to be given the opportunity under the charge to have the jury pass on that. And the way this charge is submitted, a jury can find that he published his agreement with Mr. Button without finding actual malice, without finding defamatory meaning at all.
Well, wasn't it found that it was defamatory per se? So what would the jury have to pass on that anyway?
Well, you're assuming that agreement with makes my client vicariously liable for Mr. Button's statement.
Which is a different question, but if the statements were defamatory per se, you would eliminate that element of the claim and it wouldn't be properly submitted to the fact finder, right?
If it's established as a matter of law, that's correct. But in this case, I don't think agreement with is sufficient to establish vicarious liability. And if they are, and most of their argument with respect to Colonel Gates.
I don't understand the theory to be one of vicarious liability with respect to the jury questions that you're talking about. I mean, I heard Mr. Hatchell say that he would be individually liable as a result of his conduct.
As a result, no. The damages that are awarded against Colonel Gates under question, I think it's 7 in this charge, are for the statements made by Mr. Button with which he agreed. It's not the publication of his agreement that causes the damages. It is his liability for the statements that he agreed with that were made by Mr. Bunton.
Which, as I understand Mr. Hatchell to say, makes him individually liable for defamation.
I disagree with that. I think it's clearly a vicarious liability standard. If, in fact, what you're saying is agreement with makes Mr. Colonel Gates liable for his publication of his agreement, then why isn't the damage question worded in terms of what he said and not Mr. Bunton? It's got to be a vicarious liability situation the way the damage question is worded as to Colonel Gates, because he is held liable for the effects of the publication by Mr. Bunton, not his own publication of his agreement.
But that can be the case in a conspiracy, can't it?
If you find conspiracy and you establish damages resulting from the conspiracy. But in this case, there's a dispute as to what acts were or were not committed in furtherance of the conspiracy, and it is clear that at least some of the statements made by Mr. Bunton, including the statement that Judge Bentley was a criminal, were not made in furtherance of any conspiracy because they predated the existence of any such conspiracy.
But if some were made after, why isn't that evidence to support the jury's verdict?
Well, first of all, the jury was not asked to award damages on the conspiracy theory. They were basically given a charge that said, Mr. Bunton made these statements if he acted with actual malice. What are the damages that result from those? Some of those clearly are not within the scope of the conspiracy because everybody admits they were made before Mr. Gates and Mr. Bunton even met. And then there's an issue on Gates that says if you find that he published his agreement with actual malice, what damages resulted to Judge Bentley as a result of Mr. Bunton's statements with which he published his agreement. The conspiracy issue is not picked up in any way, shape, or form in any of the damage questions, and the jury is not asked to determine what damages flowed from the conspiracy.
You agree that Mr. Bunton's statements were defamatory per se?
I agree clearly that his statement that the Judge Bentley's a criminal is defamatory per se. Corrupt, it depends on how you interpret that statement. I'm not sure that's a per se violation, but the judge concluded it was defamatory as a matter of law.
What would it take for there to be an agreement to constitute a conspiracy that would tie someone else into another's defamatory per se statement?
Well, I think there has to be a showing that the defamatory statements and the damages resulting therefrom occurred in the furtherance of the conspiracy. Conspiracy, as this court and other states have recognized, is not really... it's kind of a misnomer. There is no cause of action simply for a civil conspiracy. It's a cause of action for damages caused by acts committed in furtherance of that conspiracy. And I think in this case what they needed to do if they wanted to support liability on the basis of a conspiracy finding is submit a conspiracy damages issue. Now,
well, let me ask you, did anybody ask for that type of charge in the damage?
I don't believe anybody asked for that, either them or
well,
us.
Well, isn't there some tension between Aiken and Dahl and the Bell case, which I think to me you're relying on Bell.
No, I don't think so.
What says?
In Aiken versus Dahl, there was the defendants basically allowed, without objection, a kind of a joint submission against them, basically of both actual and punitive damages. And if you look at Justice Kilgarland's concurrence, he makes clear that had they objected, they would have been entitled to a separate submission, at least on the punitive damage question.
Well, but each co-conspirator is responsible for the actions of any of the other co-conspirators, which is in furtherance of the unlawful combination. Then what
that's
that
the key
does,
language. It's in furtherance of the unlawful combination. And mm-hmm. It's incumbent on them where that issue is disputed as to what is or is not within the scope of the conspiracy to establish what damages resulted from the conspiracy. And failing
well, but then
to do
the
that,
next statement, which is citing the Carroll case, says the concept is to extend liability in tort beyond the active wrongdoer, which in your view is Mr. Bunton, to those who have merely planned, assisted, or encouraged his act, which would be your client, Colonel Gates.
Within his acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, if you read the Carroll case, Carroll specifically holds that you are not liable as a conspirator for acts by your co-conspirators not in furtherance of the conspiracy.
In your view, then, the date of any agreement is pretty crucial vis-a-vis the damages. Is that right?
I think that's clearly correct. And I think it is undisputed in the record that at least some of these defamatory statements were made prior to the time that Colonel Gates had any participation in the Q&A program and had ever even met.
Do I recall it's about a month difference?
No, it's longer than that.
Some
of the defamatory statements are made in June, and Colonel Gates appeared on the program as a guest in July, but didn't start participating as an active participant in the program until, I think, August or September.
Separate and apart from the timing question, Mr. Wren, you said that the damages that flow from a conspiracy are the result of the acts. The two damage issues that were submitted in this case do ask what damages were approximately caused by the acts of each of the defendants. Why isn't that sufficient for those questions, separate and apart from the timing issue, to support liability for damages on the conspiracy theory?
The damage issue against Mr. Bunton is not confined to acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, and in fact clearly includes acts such as his statement that Judge...
Well, no, I understand in terms of the timing issue, but putting that apart, because of the fact that he was not on the show from the beginning of the time that Mr. Bunton began making the statements about Judge Bentley, my question is, if we don't have that issue in the case, why aren't the two damage questions that ask what amount of damages were approximately caused by the bad acts, why is that not sufficient to support an award of damages under the conspiracy theory of liability?
First of all, because the conspiracy issue is not tied to either one of those damage issues. If you look at the PJC, the way it submits conspiracy, it doesn't submit it as a separate issue, and it's assuming the same assumptions that you are making, that all of the tortious conduct is in furtherance of the conspiracy. But it has a conditioning instruction that says if you find in question one that the defendant did such and such, and if you find in question two that these damages resulted, then answer the conspiracy issue.
Well, was there any objection in this case to the failure to submit such an instruction?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Judge would basically determine the judge. You can't recover on both theories at the same time. You can't pick and choose among theories. So the judge would basically either make the plaintiff make an election, just like you do in a case, any other case that's submitted under multiple theories, or the judge would make that election for the plaintiff if they fail to do so and award them the greatest amount of damages they're entitled to under the verdict. Another problem with the conspiracy issue in this case is because
excuse me, counsel, I believe.
I'm sorry.
10 minutes has expired.
Okay.
So
thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Sirs, and how the law of the state of Texas, the code of judicial conduct, applies to those events. That's what's in dispute, not the actual factual events that took place. The only one little dispute that took place was in the case of the Curbo case, where at trial Judge Bentley brought out that there was an informal modification done, and I was not aware of that. But all of the facts that were reported on the air were actually true. Now, what I did was give you a handout to try to just to point out that in the finding, the part that's colored, in the finding there are mistakes by the Court of Appeals in the facts and in the determination of the law. I'll give you one clear case of this. The Court of Appeals said that the special prosecutor on the removal petitions found no wrongdoing about Judge Bentley involved in that. In fact, is when you read the record of the trial, you will find by Judge Bentley's testimony and by Cindy Garner's testimony, she didn't investigate the two removal petitions. Had nothing to do with it. There were three removal petitions, the ones that deal with corrupt, about the local judges dismissing them without authority under 74.059 of the government code, are different from the third one. They're different, so she cannot testify and did not testify to those. So there is a problem about the standard review on the falsity issue. One is the court had the burden of proof on the defendant. Your court just recently ruled in Turner that the burden of proof
as the U.S. Supreme Court, is on the plaintiff.
How would you ever prove such a negative? If the statement were made that I were dishonest, are you saying I'd have to go prove that I was honest? Wouldn't that be an impossible standard to ever meet?
No, ma'am. I think where it goes to, if you have examples, and this in this case is, we gave the viewer the program the information to draw a conclusion of their own. They had all of the information. And it is from those actual events that you draw a conclusion based on the standards in the Code of Judicial Conduct or on specific statutes that is dishonest, or I mean, in this case, is corrupt. And it would, you know, if in a case like you're doing, like you're pointing out, are you dishonest, you'd have to look at a specific event and see if that was a dishonest event. And it might be, under some moral standards, dishonest, but it may not be unlawful, because that's one of the definitions of corrupt. You may do something that's not moral, but it may not be illegal.
Did you ever say that Mr. Bentley was a criminal?
Yes, sir. What I actually said, there is a 24-second clip, and it is all of the evidence in the record. The only, this kind of gets to the directive verdict on falsity that's improper. But there's only a 24-second clip in Judge Bentley's and my testimony on that issue. And it is actually one of the things that I asked the court to look at, that it's not actually a statement of fact, but it is, in fact, is a hyperbole. It was in the process of a phone conversation, which the clips will not allow you. You cannot see the context, and you cannot do as you did in Turner and Rue on defamatory as a whole, because you are forbidden, because the record doesn't include all of the comments. So you only get 24 seconds of this comment, and it was kind of like in the schoolyard, kicking up the dirt. Hey, the sheriff violated the law, and you know about it. And y'all call in here and say, Joette ain't telling the truth. Y'all come on here. Y'all are the ones that are corrupt. Y'all are the criminals. And that's almost a verbatim quote, the 24 seconds.
The deal is that the jury heard evidence saying, on your part, that Mr. Bentley was a criminal, correct?
No, sir.
The jury never heard any evidence?
No, sir. They heard the 24 seconds. They heard Judge Bentley's explanation of it. They heard my explanation of it. And when you go to the standard that came out in Gonzales and Hearst, which Justice O'Neill was involved in on a directed verdict, but it was on actual malice, this is on falsity. When those all the evidence you have, you can only rule that there is a probative question that's not true.
It is undisputed that you said that Judge Bentley was a criminal.
Yes, ma'am. That is undisputed. It is undisputed that I said he was corrupt.
Okay, but it's undisputed that you said those things. Was there any evidence, or did you know one way or the other whether or not Judge Bentley was a criminal?
Yes, ma'am, and I believe that, and
so
it's
you
in.
Still, but you still believe today that he
39
is.
Of the sheriff violated
no,
39.
Yes or no?
Yes, ma'am.
And what were you going to say?
The sheriff violated 3902. Abuse of office because he failed to put this prisoner with a warrant for in jail. Judge Bentley knew about that. And under his role as a magistrate, he has authority. Now, the Court of Appeals is wrong in interpreting the law. They say he didn't have any jurisdiction. He had personal jurisdiction, and he had subject matter jurisdiction as a magistrate. And the case that really keys all of this is Justice Johnson, who's now in the Fifth Circuit, in a case called Welch versus United States. And it's clear that his duty as a magistrate, he had jurisdiction. In the 12th Court's opinion that there's no jurisdiction is wrong. And he didn't need an indictment because it was official misconduct, a misdemeanor, which put by statute the jurisdiction.
So it's your position that you said he was a criminal.
Yes, sir.
But you believe he was a criminal. Therefore, there is no malice.
Yes, sir. And as on the back side of this is a timeline to show you what went on. And that criminal charge actually came out from a phone call back in like February or March, and through a long-range investigation before that conclusion was drawn.
Let me ask you, if that is the case, would it be true if we were to rule in your favor in all future cases that somebody can completely unequivocally engage in slander of someone by accusing anyone of being a criminal, but claim to genuinely hold fast to that belief, that they really do believe they are a criminal, and as a result, always be able to evade any liability for slander.
I think we go to New York Times there about the reckless disregard, actual malice issue about that. But in this case is that the evidence shows, and what was brought in here, is that when you look at all of the parts that have to be taken to prove criminality, it's there. And it's supported by, he knew about the law being violated, the law was violated, he had a duty to follow that if you take the Fifth Circuit opinion. And there's no affirmative defense for that.
Well, is it okay to say that somebody's a criminal, even though there is no allegations pending in any criminal case,
no,
and even though a person may be found innocent?
No, I think it's not. If you don't have any facts and you don't have any reason to believe, basis to believe, then I think that would be clearly wrong. If you just pulled it out of the air, like in the Cantrell versus Forest City Publishing case, where the reporter talked about the lady being there, but she wasn't there, you made that up, and that is reckless disregard for the truth,
what
without a doubt.
What about the statement to Mr. Ferris that you've been unable to get anything on Bentley? Isn't that some evidence to undermine your belief?
Justice O'Neill, it would be some evidence if they could pin down the time good. It could also be some evidence that this was a cautious investigation, and if you listen to the videotape, you'll hear me talk to a caller on the air, and it said it took a long time to get something that I had the confidence to go on the air with to talk about this. And this issue, Mr. Ferris, and that's part of the reason for doing this chart, was to show they don't have a clue when that took place, and there's about three possibilities of courses of action that could come out of that. One of that was is the one they're arguing. The other one was, I had the conversation with Mr. Ferris prior to getting that firm belief, having no doubt that was truthful.
The Court of Appeals statement that the conversation occurred in the summer of 1995, is that, where did that come from?
That was Mr. Ferris's conversation, and that was his recollection. That's the most he could pin it down, and they never asked on cross-examination to try to pin down that any closer to try to get that to more clear and direct when that actually took place. And what counters that is that you have all of this other factual information about what happened. And the Ferris Conference says nothing, not criminal, not crook, found nothing. When you look at, and no matter how you judge the credibility, when you look at these issues.
But isn't that the point? We don't judge the credibility. It's the jury that does that. And this testimony was properly before the jury. And how can we go behind their findings in that regard?
Well, it's not just the credibility. It's the weight of all of the evidence, not just the credibility of who testified on this. But when you look at the events that took place and you take them against your code of judicial conduct, and the two events that were there were the case of the warrant and the case of Curbo. And what the record shows very clearly was that Judge Bentley made an unlawful modification or permitted an unlawful modification to the probation for Curbo. And what also happened in that case is
that
pended for 2 years.
Mr. Dunn, was that a criminal statute that you say makes it unlawful? I mean, you're asserting that if the judge makes a modification that you say is not permitted by law, there is a criminal statute that is violated by that?
No, sir, that's not criminal. The only thing that criminal had to do with, and it was only used once on June 6th in that 24-second clip, it's the only place you're going to find it in the evidence. What I was talking about, the probation deal, was about the issue of corrupt, the due process issue. And that is based on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals opinions in DeLay versus the state and Lemon versus the state, where the court very clearly states under 4212, 5 and 10, that the courts cannot let somebody else modify the conditions of probation. It belongs to the judge. There is one exception, and that
well, if
exception.
If the court did, that's an error of law, but you're asserting that that is a violation of, that is a criminal violation for which the judge can be arrested and sentenced to
No,
jail.
Sir. No, sir. Go back. Criminal only deals with the warrant. It doesn't deal with the probation. It deals with the case of where the sheriff violated the law. And the judge knew about it. And the judge did nothing about it. In his defense on the stand, he testified
I thought you said you called Judge... I thought you made reference to Judge Bentley being criminal.
Only in the case of the warrant.
But, so I've asked you, his failure to do whatever it is you said he was to do, was that his failure a violation of a criminal statute for which he could be arrested and sent to jail?
Yes, sir.
I thought you said his violation was failing to do something to the sheriff.
He has a duty under Article 2.10 of the Code of Criminal Procedure as a magistrate, which is backed up in the decision in Welch versus the United States. And that's what happened in Welch. There was a justice of the peace up in Gregg County who knew of some criminal activity going on and did nothing about it, and he was prosecuted in federal court, but the court used the state statute as the basis of doing that, and this goes back to official misconduct. Abuse of authority is if you have a duty, and that's the duty, 210, and you fail to do that duty, and it's either intentional or willful, and it benefits somebody, there's a benefit to it, and the statute does that. All three of those elements, which are three of the four elements that are required in the penal code to prove a conviction for a criminal act, are there. The other one is there anything that offsets it? And what I use in my argument is a recent opinion in Tovar versus the state where Justice Overstreet ruled that ignorance of the law is not a defense. It doesn't matter if you don't know, you don't have a duty as a judge to get involved in that. And the part where the Court of Appeals got way off base on this thing is they tried to focus on that Judge Bentley was supposed to put Mr. Harding back into jail. That wasn't the issue. The issue is that the sheriff violated the law. Judge Bentley couldn't do anything in the Harding case because there is case law that the jurisdiction of Harding was in his brother-in-law's court. But in the case of the sheriff, he had jurisdiction, he knew it, and his defense on the stand was the sheriff has discretion. It's in the record, and that is not the law. And ignorance is not an excuse.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hatchell, the jury awarded $7 million to Judge Bentley from Mr. Bunton for mental anguish damages. In a defamation case against a public figure, the First Amendment consideration, how should a court review a mental anguish damage award, and what are the parameters on that review?
I don't think that the court should review the mental anguish damage award any different than it does under any standard, with the possible exception of a due process overlay. And where those parameters are, I don't know. I mean, I have studied the entire line of Supreme Court cases and think it's probably more on a case-by-case basis.
Well, is it a question of excessiveness? Is that what we're looking at? And so we're looking at factual sufficiency review?
I think the court is well aware that I coined the phrase excessive as a matter of law in a case that Justice Baker has been on my case to some extent. So I would think that that phrase, again, in this case, excessive as a matter of law to the point that it violates due process, but where those were... The ability to draw a bright-line test for that, I think, is very difficult.
Is that something that this court can do, or would it be necessary for the Court of Appeals to do, and would be restricted by the constitutional limitations of factual sufficiency review?
Obviously, I think this court could set the standards, as it always does, and then it would be up to the Court of Appeals with its exclusive jurisdiction to review that under this court's standards.
So, but we could make the determination that the award was so excessive that it violated the due process provisions.
I don't think you could do that. No, I think you could set a standard that says that an award can be so excessive that it violates due process, and then have the Court of Appeals review under that standard.
Why is looking at the
excessiveness any different from looking at clear and convincing?
Because I think that once you get beyond the constituent elements of defamation, I don't think that the clear and convincing standard applies. I think, except to the, I just don't think it applies.
But we would, but we say we're not going to look at clear and convincing in any other context unless the federal constitution makes it.
Right.
But if it does, then we've got to, even though we wouldn't otherwise, say the same thing about excessiveness of damage. But you don't think the constitution makes it.
No, I don't think insofar as, number one, the fact of damage is concerned and excessiveness, except to the extent that there might be a due process overlay, which would candidly applies not only in beyond defamation cases, I think, but it may have some heightened scrutiny in defamation cases because of what's applied.
Mr. Hatchell, assume that somebody were to make a very public allegation that President Clinton is a criminal and is corrupt for pardoning Mark Rich, and in fact is never found guilty of any criminal liability for that. Would that be subject of the person who makes that allegation to liability for defamation? And if not, what is the difference between that case and this case?
I don't think there is any difference.
So you think that somebody who is making allegations today that President Clinton is a criminal would be subject to potential liability?
If it were false. In this particular case, I think you should bear in mind that if there was not only an allegation that you're a criminal, it says that you ought to be in jail. And that implies to me the clear imputation of a state jail felony. So, to
well, it seems to me that I have read in various newspapers claims to that extent, and I've heard on TV claims to that extent with regard to President Clinton. And are you saying that everyone who is making those allegations would be subject to liability?
If they're false. The imputation of a crime is defamatory per se. If you are a criminal, to me that imputes a crime. In this case, we do have the additional factor, though, that he tagged on to, you ought to be in jail, which implies to me not just some generic derogatory comment, but an actual violation of state law. Mr. Gates, the evidence regarding Mr. Gates is as follows. You have to begin with the proposition that Mr. Gates admitted in discovery that he has never had any personal knowledge that Bascom Bentley was either corrupt or was a criminal. Never has. There was a conversation that occurred before he assumed an active role in the program that he had with Judge Bentley, and the subject of corruption and charges of criminality was specifically brought up. And at that time, Mr. Gates agreed that the program needed to stop that, and he agreed that he was going to get involved and, quote, clean it up and make it more responsible. And then when he testified on the stand in this case, he testified that he had warned Joad Bunton that he would not use the words corrupt and criminal in describing Judge Bentley. Thereafter, however, he joined enthusiastically in saying, yeah, when Mr. Bunton would say that Judge Bentley was a criminal. He would ask him questions that said, who's the most corrupt? Knowing, of course, that the words were going to be, Judge Bentley is the most corrupt.
So and then when Ronaldo there was a... or Sally Jesse Raphael or Chris Matthews tries to encourage their guests to get more spirited in a debate, they run the risk of liability as a...
If the person that they're encouraging is uttering defamatory statements of the kind we have here, yes, I think so. So, Your Honor, those are at least three instances.
And that constitutes actual malice, too.
Yes.
It's actual malice to try to boost your ratings, I guess.
No, Your Honor, no, that's... No, we're not talking about it in... enthusiasm. We're talking about endorsement of defamatory statements of a very vile nature, corruption and criminality. Now, the restatement, you know, is just quite clear that you can publish a defamation by something other than words, gesture, pantomime, signs of the hand. If, for example, if Mr. Bunton were issuing a spew of allegations of corruption and criminality. And Jackie Gates was standing behind him going like this. I genuinely believe that that can be liable, and the restatement does too. I have given the court a little chart in our petition for review in which we assume that Mr. Bunton publishes it as a billboard outside when we walk out today that says the Supreme Court of Texas are all corrupt, they're criminals, and they need to be in jail. And Mr. Gates has a sign right next to it with an arrow pointing and says, I agree with every one of them. I believe that's a libel. I believe that's an defamation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Will the audience please rise? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Do a brief recess.